Welcome to the Theograph Podcast, a Jesus-centered, hip-hop-flavored, geeky, theological kingdom exploration. We're about three things: Jesus, theology, and hip-hop. I'm your guest host, Tyler Tully, and I hope you are ready for something new, because I have the privilege to flip the tables on Theograph Podcast tonight, as I'll be interviewing your own T.C. Moore. Good evening, T.C. How are things up there in Boston?
Hey, great. Thanks, Tyler.
Good. Now, as you are probably aware, Theograph Podcast is typically hosted by T.C. Moore, but in a special turn of events, you'll get to listen as T.C. and I converse a little bit about his spiritual journey. Over at my blog, The Jesus Event, I've been lucky enough to interview many of my friends and colleagues about their transition from their faith, the faith that they were raised in, to the faith that they have found now as their own as adults, through a special series entitled, I Once Was Blank, But Now I've Found Blank. Now, a few months ago, T.C. and I were going back and forth about where he came from, how he came to know Jesus Christ, and what struggles and freedoms he encountered along the way. But as life settled in, and it always does, we thought it would be fun to host that conversation here at the Theograph Podcast. And so tonight, we invite you to join us as two Jesus-loving, Anabaptist-type kingdom revolutionaries sit back and converse about the journey. T.C., tell us a little about where you come from.
So my story really begins in Southern California. My mom moved there just about as soon as she was able to. She was kind of fleeing her fundamentalist family in central Illinois, and she was a blonde. She was thin and beautiful. She was like prom queen of her high school. And so I guess she felt like Southern California is where she should be. And so she took off when she was still pretty young, and she went out there by herself. And not too long after that, she got into a physical relationship with a married man. And when she got pregnant, you know, he urged her to get rid of it. And she tells me that she was in the clinic in the waiting room and really felt like God spoke to her for the first time in a long time. She kind of felt like she was running from God. But at this point, she says that God really spoke to her and urged her not to go through with it. So I end up being born, and she had a really rough time out there as a single mom. And so eventually she kind of gave up, and she, you know, resorted to moving back to central Illinois. But her mom had died of breast cancer when she was really young. And her dad remarried a Nazarene woman, a really sweet lady, a nurse, but sort of a dyed-in-the-wool holy roller. And, you know, she was not proud at all that, you know, her stepdaughter had gone and gotten pregnant out of wedlock. And so she kind of put her out the house, kind of disowned her. And that led to, you know, a series of unfortunate events that my mother ended up having a nervous breakdown and being institutionalized. And I was put in foster care, bounced around from foster family to foster family. I was one of those troubled kids. And she eventually regained custody of me when I was about 8. And I was told that she was stabilized on medication, but the medication she was on was so strong that it made her like a zombie. So I remember, you know, just not being able to communicate with my mom, just her being like, just kind of not there. So, as you can imagine, fatherless kid, only child, schizophrenic mother, you know, I ran the streets, and I pretty much kind of fended for myself for many years and got into trouble and learned a lot of bad habits and ran with the, you know, wrong crowd, so to speak. And by the time I was 12, I was already sexually active, doing drugs, drinking, and gang affiliated. And then I finally got gang, you know, initiated when I was 13. Mm. Started this kind of downward spiral into self-destructive, you know, drug use and drug dealing and violence and blah, blah, blah. You know, the whole nine yards. Mm. By the time I'm 16, you know, I'm just like kind of living the life. I was, you know, pretty much had gotten all the things that I wanted, kind of the wrong way going about it. But kind of hit like a roadblock, you know, just kind of hit like a wall, where everything that I was putting my trust in started to crumble. And so the first thing that happened that really rocked me was my girlfriend that I was living with at the time had a miscarriage, and it really shook me up, because for some reason I was so, you know, I don't know, I was so ignorant that I was, you know, thought I would be a great father and just, you know, was ready to have a kid. And, you know, so the loss of that baby was just devastating. Mm. I just remember drinking a lot more and smoking a lot more weed. And shortly after that, I had two pretty rough close encounters with death.
Now, how old are you at this time?
16.
So before you were 16, you had been in and out of the foster program. Mm. You had been inducted and initiated into a gang. Mm. You were on the streets. You had moved back in with your mother, who had been stabilized with a lot of medication.
Mm-hmm.
And you had moved out and moved in with a girlfriend.
Yeah.
And you're 16.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's not even half of it. I mean, the other stuff I could tell you, you know, I grew up way too fast. The kind of stuff I was into, I shouldn't have been anywhere near, and criminal activity and, yeah, just pretty self-destructive.
Now, there is also a different reality at play. When you moved back to Illinois with your family, your mother was still in proximity to some of her very religious relatives. What was that like as they kind of came in and out of your life?
Wow, yeah. This part of my life is really odd. So yeah, my mom's parents were very religious and still are very religious. I mean, they're dyed-in-the-wool Nazarene conservative evangelicals, I would say fundamentalists. And my aunt, my wife's, my mom's sister, married into Henry Morris's family. Henry Morris is the founder of the Creation Research Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So my aunt married his son, and who subsequently died kind of tragically at a young age. But he was a guy that, like, went in search of the Ark,
mm-hmm.
You know, like Noah's Ark on Mount Ararat.
Mm-hmm.
He made several trips to Mount Ararat. So I remember one of my most vivid memories from when I was a kid is going to a family reunion, which was really odd for me because I didn't know my extended family very much. So I went to this family reunion, and all my, like, cousins and uncles and aunts were all talking about, like, how evil evolution was, and they were talking about irreducible complexities, and I had no idea what they were talking about. I didn't really care, but all I knew is that, like, this had something to do with religion, it had something to do with God and Christianity, but it didn't have anything to do with me, and it just seemed like kind of like superfluous, you know, just like, what, you know, I just remember thinking, like, what does this have to do with me and how I'm what I'm going through?
Well, you've got two different realities. I mean, they're looking for the Ark, and you're looking for a place to stay, you know.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah, they're in search of Noah's Ark, and I'm in search of someplace safe to live. And yeah.
So let's fast forward just a little bit. You're 16 years old. You're a kid, and no mm-hmm. doubt she's a kid too. Extremely traumatic event. She has a miscarriage. And then you were going on to tell us about two extremely influential experiences that occurred around that time that kind of shook the reality that you were living in. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, these two events happened in really close proximity to each other, which I think compounded their impact on my search for, you know, meaning and adolescent angst. So the first one was like, you know, there was this kid in the middle school who was beefing with one of my guys, and you know, we basically decided to jump this kid, find out where he worked. He worked at McDonald's, you know, we're waiting for him to get off work. He spots us, he calls his guys, and there's about to be like a big fight in the parking lot, right? So at first it's agreed upon that we're going to let these two, you know, just fight it out, which never goes right.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all knew that wasn't going to happen. So eventually, you know, when my guy's just beating the snot out of this other kid, you know, somebody pulls a gun and starts to shooting. And there's a point at which I felt like this dude was really about to shoot me. And, you know, like probably 20, 30 feet, you know, he's shooting at me, and I have one of those, like, your life flashes before your eyes kind of feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm dead now. This is how I'm going to die. And, it was just crazy. It was like a wake up call. It was like, could I die over this nonsense? Is this really what I want to give my life for? And shortly after that, I was still drinking heavily. So I think within the span of like a week or 2 weeks, I totaled my car driving drunk after an ice storm, which is a stupid thing to do. And I was going too fast and I wasn't wearing a seatbelt. And so all the laws of physics seemed to dictate that I should have like flown through the windshield and died, or at least been majorly injured. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason I didn't have a scratch. And even the officer that like showed up on the scene was just baffled. Like, were you in that car? He's like looking at the car. It's all, you know, totaled. The engine's just wrapped around this telephone pole. And I'm like, yeah, that's my car. And he's like, you shouldn't be here. You certainly shouldn't be like unscathed. So kind of in the short period of time, these two events really got me thinking about life and death and about, you know, God and fate and all kinds of things. Like, you know, what am I living for? I just really took inventory of my life and started to realize like the stuff I was into was just deadly. It was leading me down a path of destruction. And that was kind of the turning point, because right after that, I got a phone call from an old friend of mine who smoked a lot of weed, you know, and he was like the guy that I looked to, like, oh, he's the pothead. Like, I'm not the pothead. Mm-hmm. He's the pothead, right? So, you know, this guy calls me and he's like, I stopped smoking weed. I started reading the Bible. And I'm like, what? Like, that's crazy. Like, but he's, you know, he says like, hey, I'm getting baptized and I really want you to be there. I called you. You know, I want you to be there. And I'm like, what? That's, you know, on the one hand, I'm like, I don't do the church thing. I'm really, you know, not into that. But on the other hand, I felt kind of like honored. Like, oh, you know, he thought of me. This is special for him. This is, you know, I'm proud of him that he's, you know, getting his life together or whatever. So I kind of felt like, oh. And I think he like said, like, no, it's no big deal. I think he, you know, he played it down. He didn't really like pressure me. But I just felt like, okay, I'll do it. I'll go. But I made kind of a deal with him. I was like, I don't want to talk to any church folks. So, you know, I'll go, but I'm not going to be like, you know, sitting on the front row. I'm going to sit in the back. I'm not going to talk to nobody. And if you get, you know, dunked, I'm going to leave. And then we can talk somewhere outside the church.
Mm.
I don't want to like have a conversation in the church. So he agreed. He's like, that's fine. So, you know, I go to this Pentecostal church and I'd never been to a Pentecostal church before. So it was a little bit outside my comfort zone. Actually, it was a lot outside my comfort zone, because this whole church was like packed. And my friend Nathan was like, looked like he was going to be last to get baptized. So I felt like I was going to be there all night. And the whole choir had to like sing after every single person got baptized. It was really obnoxious to me at the time. I was like, do they really have to sing every single time? And it was something like, I don't remember how it went, but it was something like, you know, they would say the person's name and they would say like, you know, Nathan, he's on fire. He don't need the devil because the devil is a liar. And it was like really obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh Lord, get me out of here. But eventually something pretty crazy happened. Like this pastor of this Pentecostal church, Gary Grogan, he stops the service in the middle of one of these like song segments. And he, you can hear me, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I got a little like feedback there.
Sorry, I was sneezing.
Oh, that's okay. So he stops this service in the middle of this this baptism service, and he's like, I don't normally say stuff like this. I don't normally do stuff like this, but I really feel strongly like there's somebody here tonight and you nearly died this week. And there's a reason why you didn't die. It's because, you know, God has a purpose for your life and God wants to give you a new life. And he just preached the gospel. He was like, Jesus died for you, you know, you need to surrender your life to him, that kind of stuff. And I guess I'd heard that before, you know, I'd been in church, like Sunday school kind of church and youth group kind of church, you know, like, but for some reason that night, the message hit me so square in the heart. It was like, I don't know, it was like God was speaking to me personally, and I started to tremble. And I started to feel really like anxious, you know, really convicted. I would call it conviction today. And he was like, if that's you, if I'm talking about you, I want you to come down here right now. And I wasn't brave enough to just like walk down there. So I kind of slunk around to the side. Mm-hmm. And I sat down next to my friend Nathan. And I said, he said to me, like, what are you doing down here? you know? And I was like, I think he's talking about me. And I was kind of like, what should I do, you know? He was like, you should go up there. So I go up there, and this pastor basically, like, says, like, you know, you're going to get baptized tonight. He gives me these sweats, tells me to get changed. And I just did it. I don't even know, looking back, I don't even know why I did it. I guess I was just like, this is what you do when you're, you know, responding to this kind of message. So I put these on. He ushers me into the tank. I'm in the tank, and he's, like, leading me in vows. You know, he's like, do you promise to deny the devil the flesh and the world? I don't even know what that means. I'm like, yeah. He's like, do you promise to follow Jesus for the rest of your life? I'm like, sure. You know, like it's really kind of going over my head, a lot of it. But here's what I knew. What I knew is, like, I felt something real, and I wanted that new life that he talked about. So I go in the water, and he baptizes me, and I come out. And when I come out of the water, I really felt like this weight lifted off my shoulders. Felt like I felt lighter, and I felt freer. And the strangest thing that I felt right after that was I felt like love and compassion for my mom, who I had all this built up resentment for, you know. I didn't love my mom in the way that I felt like all my friends love their moms, you know. And that always troubled me. Like, why don't I love my mom the way that other people love their moms, you know? And I think part of it was because I felt abandoned. I felt neglected. You know, she was abusive at times when she was, like, off her medicine and psychotic. So I had a lot of pent-up resentment towards my mom. But suddenly, all that felt like it was replaced by this foreign love and compassion. And I just wanted to go home and, like, hug my mom and tell her what had happened to me and tell her that I love her. And, man, that was weird. That was, like, alien crawled into my soul and took over my body. And, like, you know. And the other thing that happened kind of immediately after that is, like, I couldn't really bring myself to use the kind of profanity that I was regularly accustomed to using. It was like my everyday language just didn't feel right in my mouth. And it felt kind of like, you know, like a bad taste in your mouth. So something happened to my tongue in the way that I, like, communicate. And I didn't have any desire to smoke weed. I didn't have any desire to get drunk anymore. Those things kind of, like, just evaporated. Now, that's not to say, like, I always tell people, like, everything didn't change instantly. Like, I still had major anger issues, major lust issues, major, you know, stuff that took, and still is, you know, I'm still in I'm in process, like everybody. But, you know, God was working on me then, and it still continues to work on me now. But some things just felt like night and day, just felt like a new person. And people that knew me, like, all my life, and people that knew me, you know, kind of the old TC, they look at me in the eyes and say, you're not the same person. Like, you just look like a different person. And all I can say is, like, it's Jesus, you know? Like, Jesus saved me. That's why I feel like a different person. I look like a different person.
Sometimes your body follows, you know, where your feet are leading you. And no doubt you go back to some of the, you know, friends that you had before, you know, the hustlers, the gangbanging. And you might think, like, in your own mind that this is just normal, you know, like, I'm going to go see my friends. I'm going to go hang out. I'm going to go back to the same place that I've been living. But it sounds to me like when you get there, maybe on your way to going there, you realize that things are radically different for you. And what is that like when those two worlds are colliding, where, like, you're kind of, you kind of feel like you're in somebody else's skin and you're running through some of those motions, but it sounds like your eyes were open. I mean, what was that like interacting with some of your old stomping grounds?
The way I could describe it is, like, suddenly my friends went from being, like, guys that, you know, I looked at like me. To suddenly, like, I looked at them as people, who I had compassion for, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was no longer like, you know, we're in this together. It was like, now I'm out and now I'm looking at you. Like, I want you to be out too.
It's interesting. So tell me a little bit about what it was like when you went back to your mom. 'Cause, you know, you explained a little bit about that, antagonism that you felt for her for the longest time. I mean, a lot of baggage there, you know, and things were really different after you were baptized. What was it like interacting with your mom?
Yeah. So there was definitely a lot of antagonism and a lot of, like,
anger and resentment. You know, I routinely verbally abused my mom and, you know, just cussed her out because, you know, a part of me was ashamed of her. A part of me was really angry at her for not being there for me when I was a kid, for, you know, for abandoning me, I felt like. Mm. And probably some pent up, you know, anger over just the abuse. So going back around her, you know, was a different experience because suddenly I had compassion for her condition instead of resentment. And, you know, I would pray for her regularly and I would, you know, I would just spend more time with her. I had more patience for her. A lot of stuff like that.
At my seminary, I've been really lucky to be around some people who have lately been really sharing their experiences with me about their voluntary family. You know, that is to say, a family that they have chosen. And, you know, I from what I know about gang culture, I know that it's like that. I mean, you've described that a lot of the people that you ran around with didn't have fathers. A lot of people didn't have secure families. They didn't have safety. They didn't know what they were going to eat or where they were going to be. In a real way, you know, that is their family. And, you know, as we read the scriptures, we start to see things like choosing one's family in the kingdom of God. And that seems to have happened with you when you get baptized. You're kind of adopted into a new family. Tell me a little bit about what that was like and how you kind of transitioned from the streets into the pew.
Yeah, that's exactly how I typically describe it, is I typically describe it as kind of like being adopted by this new family. The church there, you know, that Pentecostal congregation where I was spontaneously baptized, they just kind of saw me as like their kid now, like you're not, like now you're ours. And I remember, you know, first it was men in the church, older men, just started like picking me up from my, you know, from my house and like bringing me to the church to pray with them and, you know, taking me places and like letting me like spend time with them and just mentoring me, right? First it was men. Then there was like, you know, brothers and sisters in the church, you know, mm-hmm. Guys my age, girls my age, 16, 17, you know, just, and older too, like guys in, you know, in college, older in college, like spending time with me, going places. And I was just kind of like relearning what it means to be a functioning, you know, person in society. Like, I was no longer thinking like a criminal. I was no longer trying to hustle anybody or deceive anybody. I just had to relearn a lot of skills. One of the things that was shocking to me was how completely anemic my ability to relate to women on just a purely like platonic way, mm-hmm. you know. So having like friends that were female that, you know, I wasn't trying to sort of game and sleep with was new to me. It was like, oh. Because I didn't have sisters, you know, I didn't have any sisters. And so I learned what it meant to be a brother to females. And women in the church, older women in the church, you know, kind of mothered me, were very motherly towards me. And they just kind of took me in and adopted me. And the cultural shift was severe, you know. I remember just being like totally like a fish out of water on a Sunday morning, you know, people dressed nice. I didn't have nice clothes. I had to like find nice clothes. Like, you know, I didn't understand guitar music. I remember just being puzzled by the whole concept of like somebody playing the guitar mm-hmm. and singing songs out loud. It just wasn't my culture at all. You know, I didn't listen to that kind of music. It was, you know, I didn't sing. I wasn't really, you know, there wasn't like a venue where I would regularly go and sing with other people. So that's not, that wasn't part of my life, you know? And so it was all very odd, but at the same time, it felt alien, but it felt good alien. It felt like this is the right kind of different, you know, this kind of feels right. So that's why I really kind of have some resentment towards the seeker sensitive movement, because they're trying to like soften that blow. But I feel like that blow was really necessary for me. I needed to feel like the church was foreign territory. You know, I needed to feel like I'm entering a different world. This is not my world. This is God's world. And maybe there's like, you know, cultural stuff that's garbage, right? In that there's stereotypes and there's dominant culture and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it still needs to feel like this is not part of the world. This is a colony of heaven. And when you enter this community, you know, it's going to be weird at first, right? You're not going to know how to live, but you're going to learn. You're going to learn how to live. And so one experience kind of encapsulates that. I'll tell you a story. One time I was helping out with a youth group and they had a big gymnasium and it was hot. It was summertime. It was really hot. So, you know, they would run the AC all day so that the gym would be cool in the evening for the youth group. And I was helping out and I was like moving stuff in and out of this van. And so I left the doors open. I let all the cold air out. And the youth pastor kind of like chewed me out. Like youth pastor kind of gave me like a talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm a street kid. I was like not used to being told off. And so I reacted very poorly. I got angry. I yelled. You know, I slammed doors and whatever, and I had stormed out of his office, and he caught me in the hallway, really, really pissed off. He caught me, and he said to me, TC, in your old life, you got angry and you wrote people off. He said, but in the family of God, like, we're in this for the long haul. We have to forgive each other.
Mm.
And he just embraced me, and, you know, it was a totally different way of life. I wasn't used to that. I was like, no, you're dead to me. But, you know, he was right. He was like teaching me there's a new way to be in community with one another. And it requires some forgiveness and some reconciliation. And that was like a foreign concept. Like, I don't reconcile. I don't forgive, you know, but I was learning how to. So it was a really powerful moment for me.
So baptism doesn't like fix everything, right? I mean, you're still living in poverty. You're like, you still have these like cultural things that you're dealing with, just, I mean, like you said, you're a fish out of water, but at the same time, it sounds like you're surrounded by people who are loving on you, encouraging you. They've got to know that it's like radically different for you. You know, and you're probably coming aware of like things you didn't even know about yourself, you know?
Yeah.
Things you didn't even take, you know, you really took for granted.
But,
you know, one of the things that I remember talking to you about was this transition to getting like comfortable about singing songs that, you know, talked about intimacy for the first time. Like, tell me a little bit about what that was like, hearing those and experiencing that for the first time.
Man, that was weird. I mean, God as Father, singing songs to God as Father was so powerful for me as a fatherless kid. You know, who didn't do a lot of singing to begin with. So, you know, for the first time in my life, I'm vocalizing my emotions in this beautiful song. And I'm not a good singer at all, but, you know, kind of that raw, guttural emotion about God as Father. Songs like that just broke me. I mean, they just cut to the heart of me. And, you know, in those early days of being a Christian, I just felt like I was constantly just God was just constantly wrapping his arms around me. And I think we've talked about this, you and I. One of the first albums that I remember just spending hours and hours praying to was Enter the Worship Circle by 100 Portraits.
Yeah.
And I think you even posted, like, maybe it was like a tweet where you said, you know, wrap your arms around me. What's the other lyric?
Yeah,
something about...
No one has ever loved me like you love me.
Yes. Dude, that is like the lyric that would just break me. It would just be like, you know, real tears, real weeping. That album, the whole thing is just amazing. But, you know, that was a different genre of music that I had to like learn to appreciate. I remember the first guys that like introduced me to 100 Portraits, they said like, oh, you know, it's tribal sounding and it's folk,
right.
it's folk music. And I'm like, what? Like, I would never listen to anything like that. That just sounds bizarre. And they're like, yeah, they use all these like weird instruments, like pots and pans, and like, I think they even said like goat's toes. And I'm like, really?
Goat's
like,
toes.
Who does that? Right. Who does that? Right? Like, So, I mean, but there was something about it that was primitive. Like, it stripped away all the production value. And it just said, this is raw emotion. And that's what I needed at that time, was I just needed kind of to strip away all the production value and just get raw. And so I would spend hours and hours praying to, that album, Enter the Worship Circle, which was.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason why I love Enter the Worship Circle, because you brought it up, so we got to talk about it now. So, it's just the way, the freedom that they feel, first of all, to just like ad lib. They just, there's so many times in that album, and some of their other albums where they just like you said, they speak from the heart, and I think a lot of people say that about any music that they like, and that's, I mean, people probably overuse that when they're talking about praise and worship music. But there was just something about Enter the Worship Circle where you really felt like the guy might have been making up prayers like just then and there when the recording button was on.
Oh,
And
absolutely.
just the permission that they felt to like talk to God that way. And that intimacy, like you said, I mean, there's something about that.
And think about my context too. I'm a new Christian in a Pentecostal congregation. So when Pentecostals talk about singing a new song or singing in the spirit, that's immediately what I think of. I think of 100 Portraits ad-libbing. That's exactly what comes to mind. It's like that's singing in the spirit. That's singing a new song,
Okay, so you had already been exposed to New Orleans through this, kind of a brief mission type thing, and then it's obviously on your radar, but you decide to go down there. Tell us a little bit about that transition.
So my church was a part of a broader denomination of Pentecostals, and every year, a few evangelists, like four or five evangelists, would organize a trip down to New Orleans for Mardi Gras and bring like Pentecostal college students, Bible college students down there and do street events. So I did that twice. I did that in 99 and I did it in 2000. Or maybe it was 2000. No, I did it in 2000 and I did it in 2001. And in 2001, I was a pastoral intern for that Pentecostal congregation. My pastor, Terry Austria, had preached this message on investing in lives. And during that message, I just really felt like God spoke to me in a personal way, and confirmed my suspicions that he was calling me into full-time ministry. And so when I told Terry, he was like, "Okay, you can intern for me." And so, he let me like preach sometimes in the college ministry, and he let me lead Bible studies and evangelism crusades and things like that. And so the second time I went down to Mardi Gras, I was an intern for this campus ministry in Illinois. And when I completed that internship, he basically sent me to Bible college, gave me like my first semester's tuition. And I moved down there with that was all I had to my name, was just one semester's tuition. And he sent me to this small Pentecostal Bible college that specialized in urban ministry, because that's what I knew God was calling me to, was urban ministry. I didn't know where, I didn't know what city, but I knew I was going to be serving in the city. And so I went to this small Pentecostal school called the School of Urban Missions, and it was jointly owned by the Assemblies of God and the Church of God in Christ, which up until that point, I don't think had ever kind of partnered in any institution whatsoever, since the split. Because the Assemblies of God split away from the Church of God in Christ in like 1916 or something like that, or 1914. So 100 years ago. And so I went to that school in New Orleans when I was 19.
You're 19, but not so young. I mean, like you'd lived a pretty full life at that time.
Yeah, I felt pretty grown.
Yeah, I mean, and all of a sudden, as it is the case for us that study theology in different ways, you're starting to like be given, or rather, probably inheriting language to use for a lot of these things that you had already experienced. Like you talked a little bit about the baptism coming out, you're confessing these things and you're like, you know, all I know is what I know in my heart. And I may not have the words, you know, the symbols for this, but you're starting to get that when you're in New Orleans. And something else that radically will change your life starts to occur because you meet somebody when you're in New Orleans, right? You got to tell us how you meet Oshita.
So what happened with Oshita was she was down there for a missions trip, kind of like what we were doing. She went down there with her church, like college and career group,
mm-hmm.
To do short-term missions trip, Mardi Gras outreach, that kind of thing. Sidewalk Sunday School in the projects. And the school that I went to was majorly focused on hands-on urban ministry experience. So they would host missions trips, and you'd go out with the students, and you'd do these ministry practicums, you know. And so I'm there to scope out the school. Like, I'm there, like, for campus days, you know. And so I'm thinking about going to this school. And so, you know, I'm peeping her. I actually peeped her when she got off the elevator for the first time, and I was like, I'm gonna keep my eye on her this week. So this is how I tell the story. When we tell the story, you know, we tell it a little bit differently, but, here's how I tell the story. I tell the story that, so, you know, I'm in chapel. We had chapel like every day, and, you know, I'm kind of having this internal dialogue where I'm like, why is it so taboo in Pentecostal circles to, you know, compliment a woman on her beauty? You know, that's off limits. You can't do that. That's lust. That's something inappropriate, right? So I'm like, I'm telling myself, no, it's not. That's not inappropriate. Like, you could just say, look, I think you're beautiful. Nothing, you know, skeezy about it. I just think you're beautiful. So I basically like talk myself into it. I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna do that. So I walk up to her after chapel and I'm like, I hope you don't mind me telling you this, but you know, I think you're beautiful. And she was like, thank you. And she turned her and walked away. And I was like, well, you know, you win some, you lose some. Like, no, you know, like, it was worth a shot, right? It was worth a shot.
Right.
But come to find out subsequently, you know, later, she took it as like some kind of prophetic encouragement. She took it as like, I was coming to her as her brother in Christ. God's telling me to tell her that she's beautiful. And it's like, you know, it's God's way of saying like, you're beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm. And maybe she has no idea. Who knows?
Maybe it was, but on my end, I had no, right. That was not my intention at all. But the next time she comes to chapel, you know, the next day, she's like, hey, come sit by me. And I'm like, hey, maybe this worked. So by the end of the trip, you know, we've decided to like exchange emails. That was how far we'd gotten. So we exchange emails. We do like the long distance email thing for a couple months, I think, just emailing back and forth, asking each other questions, which I think is a good way to start because you don't introduce things too quickly, you know, just get to know each other. And it was good. In those days, it was like text only email.
Right.
So it wasn't like any, I don't even think there wasn't even emoticons or.
And our kids will never understand.
Nah. Nah, it was no, yeah. So then we graduated to phone numbers. And in those days, I was buying phone cards. You know, I was buying phone cards to call her in Texas.
Because it's long distance.
Yeah, yeah. I go back to Illinois. She goes back to Texas. And it's long distance. And we're buying phone cards, burning those suckers up. And, you know, talking till the wee hours in the morning. And then I moved to New Orleans and still doing the long distance thing. She's still in Texas, but I visit a couple times. And so we're dating. And I think, you know, at that time, so this is going to make you laugh. At that time, Joshua Harris's book, I Kissed Dating Goodbye, had come out and was sweeping through evangelical culture like wildfire. And my school just adopted it hook, line, and sinker. It was like, if you weren't courting, right. You were in sin.
Right.
So, you know, I think we had a conversation like, hey, should we court, you know, should we start courting, something like that. And I was basically like, hey, you know, I need to ask your dad for, you know, no, that came later. So it was like, you know, are we serious enough to like get married? Because if not, we should probably cut this off or we should start courting. And, you know, I think we decided like we're serious, so we're going to court. Well, I got to ask your dad for your hand in marriage. We did the whole program, man. We were deep into that culture.
So I think the first time that I ever heard of you or became associated with you was after you had already been in the trenches of open view of the future, open view theology. Tell me a little bit about that transition, because it's not like one day you wake up out of bed and you're like, oh yeah, I'm an open view theist, you know? So like, how did you get introduced to that theology?
It actually did kind of happen kind of suddenly. I had a conversation with a mentor when I was still a new Christian. I think I was still 16. I might not have turned 17 yet, or maybe I was just turned 17. But basically, the conversation went like this. I told him that I was really burdened for my friends who were still, you know, living self-destructive lives. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to pray for them. And I was really concerned about their, you know, their souls, right? I wanted them to be saved. And this mentor was a missionary, like a veteran missionary. He spoke like four languages, I think like German and French and all these other languages. And he was a really wise man, older, much older man than me. And I remember we were at like a Steak and Shake. And he said, well, TC, like, you're elect and they're not elect. And that's why, you know, you're saved and they're not. And that was my introduction to that language of like election. And I was like, come again? Like what?
Right.
Like that doesn't even make sense to me. And he's like, well, let me show you. And he like flips open his Bible to like Romans 9. And he reads me out of the Bible, Romans 9, just like up until the point where it says like, who are you, oh man? And I'm like, I'm like peeping this. I'm like, this doesn't make sense. I'm like, I know the Jesus that I met, you know, that night, and he's not the kind of God that like picks people before they're born to go to heaven and go to hell. So I told him, I was like, listen, like, I don't know what that passage means, but it can't mean what you're saying it means. It can't. It just can't mean that, because I know the Jesus that I met the night that, you know, he got a hold of my heart.
Wow.
And this mentor of mine was like just really kind of adamant, like, who are you, oh man, to talk back to God? Like, that's the way it is, TC. Like, and you just have to get used to it. I was pretty pissed. I was just like, I don't care what you say. Like, I would never worship a God like that. I just wouldn't. Like, that God seems like an evil monster God to me. And it kind of set me on a path, like, it kind of piqued my curiosity. Like, now I want to know, what is this what is the deal with this predestination election talk, you know? So I just started devouring books, man. I just read everything I could get my hands on. I just started reading. And I think the first couple of books I read were like C.S. Lewis books. You know, I read Problem of Pain. I read, you know, Mere Christianity. Mere Christianity and The Problem of Pain were really helpful in this regard. I remember C.S. Lewis talking about God's omnipotence. And he said that God can't create, you know, things like married bachelors or round triangles. These are logical contradictions, you know, and if that's not a limitation on God's power, that's a limitation on the rational world that God has created, right? And so I started to kind of piece the puzzle together, like, well, okay, so how does that affect omniscience, right? So God knows everything that's going to happen before it happens. I mean, that settles the future in advance of people's decisions. And that would basically make us automatons. So the way I started thinking about it was, well, in the same way that God can't create married bachelors and can't create round triangles because they're contradictions in terms, God can't foreknow as a certainty that which is not certain yet because it hasn't been chosen yet. And I started to kind of reason that, okay, well, then that would mean that the future is partly indeterminate. Started talking to some friends of mine about it, kind of like very hush-hush, like, hey, I don't want this to get out. This is kind of crazy thinking, you know. And some of my friends were like, no, that sounds like something I've heard taught at YWAM. And I was like, for real? And so I started talking to these YWAMers. They're like, yeah, like there's some teachers that teach that. And they didn't have a term for it. I don't remember it ever being called the open view. But they said, yeah, like that's kind of like the way that they teach God's foreknowledge in YWAM. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. So that was like my first kind of introduction to it. Then the big next leap forward was I read an essay by Clark Pinnock. It was called From Augustine to Arminius, A Pilgrimage in Theology, where he details his journey theologically from being a 5-point Calvinist to being an open theist. And, I mean, he details it really, really well, kind of the way that it unraveled for him. It started with Perseverance of the Saints. He was reading and teaching on, he was a professor at the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary,
mm-hmm.
and he was reading and teaching Hebrews, and the really stark, you know, commands to persevere in Hebrews really got him like questioning the perseverance of the saints. He was like, why does the writer of Hebrews keep like urging the early church to persevere if perseverance is basically a given? So that kind of like started unraveling the ball of yarn, right? So he's like, step by step, he's like going back, like, well, what about, you know, irresistible grace? What about limited atonement? What about unconditional election? What about total depravity? Before he knows it, he's like, I got to get back to the Bible and just start over.
Mm.
He just starts over. He's like, I've inherited this system, and now I don't think this system is biblical. So let's find out what's biblical.
Our generation can't really talk about the open view without also talking about Greg Boyd. And I know you've been able to develop a little bit of a relationship with Greg over the years. Tell me about how you got introduced to Greg Boyd and his ministry and how that has helped shape during that transition into this new way to look at God in the future.
Right. Well, remember that I was Pentecostal, right?
Right.
So my introduction to Greg Boyd was because of his work in spiritual warfare. So he wrote a book called God at War, which was like, you know, the Bible of spiritual warfare for Bible geeks, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you were a Bible college student and you cared about spiritual warfare, you read God at War and you read Satan and the Problem of Evil, because that was like the next logical, okay, well, what do you do with Satan, right? What do you do with evil? What do you do with theodicy? So I knew about Greg Boyd through that kind of stream of thinking, spiritual warfare stuff. But when I read God of the Possible, that was his introduction to the open view.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so straightforward. It was so straightforward. It was just like, here's the issue. The issue is the Bible has two motifs, a motif of future determinism, where God determines the future, and a motif of future openness, where God sees the future as partly open. And he's like, they're both true. They're both true. The future is partly open and the future is partly determined to the extent that God chooses to determine it or leave it open. And to me, that just made all the like coins fall in the slot. I was like, yeah, that totally makes sense, right? When you read the Bible, there's passages where it feels like the future is a certain thing.
Because it seems to all come down to, does God choose or not? You know, because open view theists and Calvinists both believe that God chooses. The point that you seem to be making here, though, is that God's choice is still open. God can choose and God can choose not to choose. Either way, God makes a choice.
Right. Yeah. Both views, I think, you know, emphasize the freedom of God, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would call that, is the freedom of God to be sovereign over his own sovereignty. But I think that in the open view, at least, you know, we're trying to keep that as biblical as possible. And there's passages that seem to say God is changing his mind, right? Like, I remember one of the passages I wrestled with early on was Moses in Exodus 4, talking with God about the elders of Israel, mm. right? And God's sending him to the elders of Israel, and God's like, if you show them this sign, they might believe you. But if that doesn't work, here's another sign. Oh, and if that doesn't work, here's a third sign. And I'm like, what the heck? Like, God doesn't know how many signs it's going to take to convince the elders of Israel?
Mm-hmm.
He seems to know that at most it'll take three, and at least it'll take one. There's kind of a range, right? It's like, it'll either take one or three or two, but not four. And they're definitely not going to believe you straight away.
And sometimes God shoots from the hip, you know, like I'm thinking about Genesis 2, when God creates Adam and then sees that it's not good that Adam is alone and then decides to make Adam a partner. But the funny thing is that the scripture says that God brings all the animals that God has created to Adam to see if they would be suitable. And then God realizes, oh, you know, these aren't suitable. Let me create woman, you know? So it's like,
right.
God has a freedom in the scripture to work with what God makes.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's kind of a Western lens. I mean, we call it classical theism that we impose on the Bible. And we say, that's not really how it goes. Right.
Mm-hmm.
We say that's, you know, that's all anthropomorphism. That's all, you know, just hyperbole. Like, we just find a way to kind of dismiss all that. But what if it's actually teaching something true about God? Right? What if it's actually teaching that God does have a freedom that engages time and engages humanity in a dynamic way? What if that's true? You know, if that's true, then the Bible seems a lot more alive when you read it than if we're constantly imposing this lens on it that says, that's not really the way God is. We know God's really not like that. That's just kind of the way the authors thought, right? That just feels to me like we're imposing our will on the scriptures rather than letting the scriptures kind of inform us about the character of God and the nature of God. So a lot of the reason why I've been attracted to the open view is that I think it takes the Bible really seriously, you know, and I want to take the Bible really seriously.
So how did you get introduced to Greg on a personal level?
So one of the ways I got introduced to him on a personal level was that I was looking for a time when I could hear him speak in person, right? So at that time, he had a ministry called Christus Victor. And I went to his website, and he had like a calendar page. And on his calendar page, it said, you know, hey, he's going to be in Boston. And it was like he was going to be in Boston like the next week. I was like, what? Like, that's crazy. Like, I just looked up to see, you know, if he's going to be in my area. And I'm thinking like New York, right? I'm thinking like he'll visit New York eventually. But I look on his website, it says he's going to be in Boston like the following week. So I look and it's like the Open Theology and Science Conference. And I'm interested in science too. So I'm like, that's perfect. I want to go to this conference. So it's in Boston where there's like 50 schools. So I'm thinking like, this place is going to be packed. You know, I got to get there early. I got to like, you know, get a seat, whatever. I go there and I'm like one of like a handful of seminary students. Literally, like handful of seminary students. It's me, Clark Pennock, Greg Boyd, John Sanders, and like every author of the Openness of God book, right? Like Bill Hasker's there, Richard Rice is there. It was amazing. So I spent like, you know, 5 days with those guys, you know, introduced myself to Greg, and we kept in touch via email. Then I started like an open theism Facebook group, and it grew and grew and grew, and like there's now like several hundred. One of the groups that I administer on Facebook has over 1,000 members. And so several of the guys in the group were like, hey, we should start a conference. Like, we should have a theology conference. So me and Tom Belt, Tom Ord, who's a professor at Northwest Nazarene Seminary and an open theist, and Marcia Erickson, who's on the board of Renew. Renew Ministries is Greg Boyd's new ministry. The four of us co-directed a theology conference, an open theology conference at Woodland Hills. Greg was one of the keynote speakers. John Sanders was one of the keynote speakers. And Tom Ord was the third keynote speaker. And that it was at that conference that I met Jessica Kelly in person. And she brought the house down. It was amazing. It was like, I tell people, I'm like, nobody cared about Greg Boyd and John Sanders and Tom Ord anymore. They were like, who is Jessica Kelly and how can we hear more from her?
Jessica, you know, wow. You know, one of the things that I think deconstructs everything we think we know about God or life or like what matters is when the shit hits the fan, you know, like when like real life happens. You know, right. When theodicy is what we call in theology, when like evil happens to good people. And Jessica Kelly, you know, you've had her here on Theograph before.
Yeah.
There's just something about the glass, like, castle getting, you know, shattered at its core when it hits the fan, you know, like real life sets in and all of a sudden everything you think you know gets challenged. And at the end of the day, what you're reminded of is what you know that you know. You know, that feeling that you had when you were baptized the first time, before you had that language, those personal experiences that we can't necessarily, you know, make sense of. I mean, it's one of the things that I appreciate about Pentecostalism, about charismatic Christianity in general, is that there is that tribalism that is – tribalism is a poor word. It's kind of that, you know, stripped down, naked, raw, like next to the earth, organic, you know, realism, you know, like where you can speak to somebody in truth, where like, you know, it's about it's about real life. It's almost like caveman Christianity, you know, like, and I mean that in a complimentive way. And that is your background, and to an extent, it's my background too, but it's definitely a theme, you know, because charismatic Christianity reaches people that are never reached by lofty, you know, Christianity.
There's
something about it, you know. It's like you were saying, I mean, you're going on the streets in New Orleans, like you're, you know, baptizing like gangbangers, like, you know, literally off of the street. There's just something about it. And as you, you know, mentioned Jessica Kelly here, I'm just kind of reminded of, like, there's this theme, you know, throughout your life of, like, realism coming to the forefront of what, you know, your faith experience.
I'm reading this this book by Amos Young called Renewing Christian Theology, Systematics for a Global – or Renewing Christian Theology, Systematics for a Global Christianity. And he's approaching systematics from a global perspective, and he's like, the global church is a renewalist church.
Mm.
Renewalist being like a umbrella term for charismatic Pentecostal. And, you know, I really love the perspective that he's coming at, because he's like, you know, this is the future. Like, you want to know what Christianity looks like. It's a multicultural, multi-ethnic, charismatic Pentecostal church. That's what it looks like. And it's happening now. Like, that's not just the future. That's the now.
And it's happening for you now too. I mean, you moved up to Boston, you started seminary, you were part of a church plant there. That didn't pan out, and that was difficult to go through. I mean, for you and your family, for every seminarian, there are these times where you're constantly like questioning, am I doing the right thing? Is this what I'm called to? I mean, even if you've been called, but you know, you're up there and you're trying to do this, and then some things kind of fall through the cracks, but then just recently God's doing a new thing in your life. So tell me a little bit about the transition from the old thing to this new thing, given that kind of multi-dimensional renewal, multi-ethnic kingdom that God is building up there in Boston.
Yeah, this is kind of a really wild adventure that we're on. After our church plant, you know, didn't take off at the pace that our denomination wanted, and they pulled funding. My wife and I were in a really low place, just feeling like disconnected from the church, disconnected from the body, and didn't really know where to turn. And I've got mentors, and she's got mentors, and they're all speaking into our lives and all encouraging us. And one of my mentors was saying that, hey, there's a new church plant down in Dorchester, which is an urban inner city neighborhood of Boston.
Yeah. Dorchester Heights, baby.
Yeah, yeah. And so he's like, there's this new church plant down there. And he said, man, I visited, and it's like everything you wanted, TC. It's like, it's multi-ethnic, it's Jesus-centered, it's missional, like they're doing outreach, they're all about Jesus. It's great. So I'm like, yeah, I gotta check that out. So, you know, we go and we visit, and I'm telling you, like, our first Sunday there, we just felt at home. We just felt like this is where we belong, you know? And so we kept coming back, and like the fourth Sunday we were there, you know, I was meeting with the pastor regularly. We were having like breakfast together, and he was telling me that, like, they're trying to go to a more, you know, plurality of leaders kind of model. He really doesn't want to be like this traditional kind of lead pastor guy. You know, he wants to have a teaching team, and he's cultivating this teaching team, and he invites me into the teaching team. And it just so happens that on the teaching team already is an Asian American pastor named Mako Nagasawa. And he's just a really brilliant leader here in Boston in inner varsity. And I've looked up to Mako for many years and learned a lot from him from afar. But now I'm able to like rub shoulders with him in this new church plant. And Rick is really passionate about Jesus and loves the Bible. And so all of a sudden I'm thrust into this team that really feels like a dynamic, you know, dream team.
That is
Oshida
beautiful.
Oshida too.
That is beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, TC, as we wrap up, I just want to tell you that I appreciate your ministry, man. And it's been a real joy just to hear about like where you've come from, where you've been, where you're going, how you got there. Because I know you're still on your journey like the rest of us are. Mm-hmm. And it never stops. You know, it never stops. And so thank you for the opportunity to converse with you about this on Theograph. And I look forward to seeing where this goes in the future.
Man, thank you for doing this. Thank you for, you know, guest hosting. And you do a great job, man. Like, you know, I want to bring you on full time. Let's do it. Let's do a tag team.
All right, brother.
All right, man.
Talk to you later.
All right. Peace.